And this is AWOL Radio. RadioWaterloo.ca, CKMS 102.7, Rogers Cable 946 in Waterloo Region. It's Friday the 15th of December. In response to the unannounced start of the clear-cutting of a 57-acre forest and wetland in the southwest of Winnipeg in 2017, Jenna Vandell, a Métis woman, blocked machinery on the site and put out a call for action and support. In short time, a land defense camp was established to block further destruction of the site. This was the Roostertown blockade. After 2 months of the blockade successfully stopping work on the site, a judge granted an injunction requested by the landowner and developer, Andrew Marques, for the blockade to be cleared. And while the land defenders left the site without arrest, the developer named 49 people in a lawsuit, seeking at least $500,000 in damages. Today on AWOL Radio, we are speaking with a spokesperson from the Roostertown blockade.
Hello, James Wilt. Beyond being a spokesperson for the Roostertown blockade, can you introduce yourself more thoroughly and let our listeners know why you became involved in this land defense action?
James, I'm a Winnipeg-based freelance journalist. I do that full-time, so I work on a bunch of different subjects, but mostly it comes down to like environmental and energy-related policy things. And so I got involved in, you know, supporting the Roostertown blockade around when it started. I saw it as something that was really significant as a settler myself to show support for an Indigenous-led blockade. As you mentioned, Jenna Vandell herself is Métis, and so there's a great significance to the area, which we might get into in a bit in terms of, you know, why the forest matters historically and such. And then also just from an environmental point of view, there were wetlands there, which, as I'm sure many of us know, play really important roles in terms of dealing with precipitation and such, which in a world of increasing climate change and such is really important. So from that point of view, and then there's just the pure ecological and biodiversity argument. It's really good to have green spaces where wildlife and plants can grow and thrive, and also people can visit and use it as a space to, you know, find peace or meditate or walk their dogs or those sorts of things. So it was a bunch of different issues which kind of coalesced into one and compelled me to help support it.
Why is this camp called the Roostertown Blockade? What is the significance of the area the camp or the blockade was set up in?
So it's named after a Métis, what they call a so-called shanty town, which was first established in the 1880s as a lot of Métis people were being displaced from their ancestral homes. And so the town was called Roostertown, and it was demolished in 1959 to build Grant Park Mall, which is a sizable mall in Winnipeg. And so it sort of once again displaced a lot of the residents. And so it was named Roostertown because the forest, which was eventually clear-cut, was, I mean, it's not just believed to be. It was definitely a site where there was a lot of hunting ceremonies. There's a lot of ceremonial structures found in the forest itself, as well as housing structures and arrowheads and tin and metal and old foundations and all that kind of thing. So it's quite clear that people who used to live in Roostertown used the forest for food and play and perhaps even residence itself. And so Jenna sort of named it after that, just to really show respect to the people who came before and just to really sort of reiterate that the land defense itself was very much rooted in, you know, recent history, and that this is an ongoing example of colonialism, which, you know, dates back to obviously 1959 when Roostertown was demolished, but even before that with the 1880s when Métis people were forcibly displaced, and even before that. So it's kind of drawing a lineage throughout recent history.
Is this site, this type of clearing common in Winnipeg right now? Is there a lot of sprawl going on or clearing of land for what I assume to be development?
I think most of this kind of thing has already been done, to sort of build what we understand to be Winnipeg today. And so I do think it is why it mobilized a lot of people around it, was because there are so few examples of this sort of sizable green space left. And until 2009, it was public lands. And so it was owned by the city, and It was a land swap that happened, which was very controversial at the time. And ever since, it's been something that's been quite heavily contested by local community members. And even since 2009, it's been used quite freely as a space to walk dogs or to play or that sort of thing. And so I think it is a fairly, I mean, I'm definitely not an expert on green space in Winnipeg per se, you know, like across the board. But from what I've seen personally, it is, there aren't that many spaces less like this. So I'm sure there is similar clear cutting going on. I'm a total guess that it's not as much as there was in the past just because it's already all been done.
Right. Right. So there was a blockade set up. How did the blockade come to be, and like how did things go? There was like 2 months of stopping stopping work.
About one third of the Aspen Forest was clear cut suddenly without any sort of notice on July 6th. And so that all happened in a day or two. And Jenna, who was living quite nearby, found out about it. And so on July 12th, 6 days later, her and a couple of other community members just basically plopped down a tent. And that camp grew in number. So sort of at its peak, there were probably about a half dozen sort of tents where people could stay overnight. And then in addition, there was sort of a two, like if you go camping, you can, you know, set up a tent for a kitchen and right. then sort of recreational. And so there was sort of a joint thing, and then there were banners hanging on the side there. And so it was a system where people would take shifts, because the idea was just to have, you know, at least one person on site at all times, and just, you know, to be able to make a call out to other people if, say a mulcher showed up, or if fencing was being put up, or that sort of thing. And so it was sort of more of like a watchdog thing, as opposed to, like, you know, active confrontations every day. Yeah. Although, you know, oftentimes the foreman would show up and, you know, just reiterate that this is private property and this is, you know, illegal to be here and all these sorts of things. And so that would happen, and there would be those interactions. And near the end, they did establish a more, you know, militant presence by hiring a security firm and putting up fencing and a gate. And so in order to access the property, one would have to duck under the gate and basically ignore the security guard in some capacity. So, yeah, it was just a lot of, you know, showing up. Sometimes you just be there for a few hours, do some homework, read a book, just keep an eye out. And, you know, even though one third of the forest had been demolished on July 6th, there still was a lot of wildlife in the area. You know, so you'd see deer run by, and so you'd sort of make note of that and just sort of see the movements and the behaviors of various animals and just keeping track of where they're at, because, you know, you install fencing, it's going to limit what used to be fairly typical migration patterns for them. So, you know, it's not like we were, you know, wildlife biologists or anything, but it was just, you know, kind of keeping track of things like that. And then at least one time there was a former resident of Roostertown, an older Métis man who came down to the site, invited by Jenna, and sort of gave a bit of a talk about what it was like to grow up in that area and, you know, the significance of the forest, and just kind of confirmed a lot of what people, you know, really believed that they were there for, which was to, you know, really protect lands which have been used for a really, really long time by Métis and First Nations people, and more recently, you know, sort of local community members. And so, yeah, it you know, it varied in terms of people's ability to participate. You know, people were, you know, like the actual participants ranged a great deal. You had, you know, university students, or you had retired people, or you had environmentalists or dog walkers or indigenous land defenders or minimum wage workers, or, you know, it was a real, you know, combination. So I think right. people's capacities sort of shifted over time, and, you know, some people could devote a lot of time for a week where they'd show up, you know, once a day for a whole week, and other times it would be more intermittent. So that was, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, the group kind of had to learn, was, you know, how do you keep a consistent schedule without putting too much of a burden on people, because, you know, burnout's a real thing for mm-hmm. anyone involved in activism. So yeah, so it's just, you know, a lot of that. There'd be the occasional meeting, you know, we'd just kind of regroup, figure out what priorities are. People would bring down food. You know, we had local community groups who would donate, you know, entire meals. People would pick up dishes, clean them. You know, it was just sort of this, like, very, it was fairly ad hoc, but it did feel like collaborative, and that, you know, we were learning things along the way. Right. And then, of course, it got shut down.
You mentioned people have been concerned about this area or working to protect this area for a while. What kind of support did the action receive from others in the area and across the city?
I would say it was really solid. We would get people popping by. BBC reported on this at a time, but Indigenous guy from the North End walks all the way, which is an enormous, like, hours and hours to, you know, come and show support. There was very consistent presence from Urban Warrior Alliance and American Indian Movements, which are two militant Indigenous groups in the city. They were, like, really driving the camp itself. But then there are other, you know, people who, you know, used to walk their dog in the area and would, like, literally just be walking by with their dog and are like, holy crap, this, you know, a third of this forest is no longer here. So they would, you know, come and drop by and just ask a few questions. A lot of people were really, really upset. You know, I recall, you know, one guy coming by and just he grew up really near the area and used to play there, you know, in his childhood. And just like coming by and you could just, you know, he was so angry and upset. And so, you know, people who may not have heard about it in the news, but were just walking by. And then we would have, you know, support from unions or, you know, activist groups or, you know, whether they're bringing food or just giving us a shout out on, you know, social media or, you know, sort of any sort of range of supports. And that's increased, you know, since the camp was shut down and we've been facing this lawsuit and everything. Like, we have received an enormous amount of support, which is really incredible and beyond Winnipeg too. You know, there's obviously kind of focused here, but there's people across the country who have, you know, reached out to express, you know, solidarity or give a donation or that kind of thing. And so it's been really cool to see.
Right. The 57-acre parcel of land itself, can you share your understanding of how the developer ended up in possession of the Roostertown lands in the first place?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's over this entire conversation was it definitely not to imply that there was, you know, the same level of sketchiness at the time, but it did happen in the same era as Sam Cates, who was former mayor of Winnipeg, who wound up in some extremely controversial land swaps. It was a controversial fire hall swap with Shindico, and there's a whole lineage of what people call borderline corrupt land deals with private developers. And so not to say that this was that, but it happened within the same time frame.
Right.
And so it was basically a one-for-one swap. The city had a parcel of land, which they swapped with developer Andrew Marquez, who owns Gem Equities. And from what I understand, there wasn't a up-to-date evaluation done of the property values of both. It was just listed as both being worth $1 million. And so it was just a one-for-one swap.
Oh, wow.
And there have been questions and challenges of that ever since, you know, about the sort of just the process surrounding that, if that was the right way to do it, if there was enough transparency, if there should have been sort of more consultation with local community members, including, you know, Métis and First Nations people, you know, as opposed to just taking what is a really, you know, beloved public space, which had actually been previously deemed by the city to be an ecologically sensitive area.
Right.
And then just sort of all of a sudden swapping it. And so at the time, there were sort of community town halls led by sort of Parker Wetland Conservation Society and, you know, other concerned citizens and, you know, really people who are quite outraged that this happened because Andrew Marquez is a fairly, I think it's fair to say, notorious private land developer in the city. He's been involved in dozens of lawsuits, both suing and being sued. Is currently wrapped up in a lawsuit by Mike Holmes from Homes on Homes,
right?
And like things like that. And so it's like it's when it happened. I think people were aware that something like this could happen eventually, and so that was a concern. I know that, you know, some people in the group or some supporters of what's going on are still sort of taking a look at that initial land swap just to continue asking questions and you know, really pressuring the city to, you know, show their homework. Like, how did this happen? You know, was there sufficient transparency, consultation, all the rest? And so hopefully more information on that will come to light. But yeah, I don't have a ton of info on how that actually went down.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like anybody really, really does so far. And yeah, it'll be interesting to find out if there is more follow-up on that. Yeah. Now, obviously, they've had a large role, but what has been the role of the local governments in all of this? I've read that Mayor Bowman, for one, is pushing for a platform of reconciliation in Winnipeg. How have his actions reflected this platform?
I think many would argue no in this particular instance. Like, Mayor Bowman is Métis himself. He, like you say, he has, you know, in the wake of that McLean's article about how Winnipeg's, you know, allegedly the most racist city in Canada, he really worked hard to acknowledge the history of racism and you know, really try to, you know, put work into, you know, trying to resolve some of these questions. Like you say, recently signed a reconciliation accord or agreement. And so what happened was Jenna Vandel reached out to him and they were able to have a meeting about this. The hope was, like, eventually that the city would step in, that they would either pressure Marquess and Gem Equities to, you know, to hold off on clear cutting until a development plan had been approved and until adequate consultations had been done. I think really ideal outcome would have been a complete moratorium on clear cutting until consultation and then potentially eventual expropriation of the land by the city. And like it sounds extreme, but at the same time, you know, going back to the question before, this is public lands, you know, and there was this controversial swap and Mayor Bowman has committed to doing these things. And I believe it was the Free Press sort of quoted him at one point. And, you know, the best that he could come up with was that, you know, he hopes, you know, Marquess doesn't clear cut it. Like it was very, it wasn't forceful language. You know, it wasn't like he was coming down on any one side. And I understand that he's in a very particular position as mayor of the city, and he's had run-ins with developers, especially early on in his career. So he's probably making, you know, particular political calculations, which I get. But at the same time, this does seem like an issue which the city could make more of a move on. And we've seen them, you know, since then actually do that, actually, you know, request that developments not happen in particular green spaces. And so, like, it's clear that this could have happened, but for whatever reason, you know, perhaps he knows that, you know, Andrew Marquess is quite a forceful developer himself and, you know, really wants to get his way. So perhaps he just didn't want to pick that fight at this point. But I would say that many in the group were disappointed by the fact that he didn't sort of step up to really put actions behind the words that you mentioned.
Other spots in the political arena on October 11th, Manitoba NDP MLA James Allum paid tribute to the Parker Wetlands Conservation Committee and the Roostertown blockade in the legislature. Just like to quickly play the clip, as there is audio available.
Gary Riverview.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I rise today to pay tribute to those who have rallied to protect the Parker Wetlands in West Fort Garry. For many years, the Parker Wetlands Conservation Committee, a group of local activists, worked tirelessly to preserve this valuable green space. More recently, others have come forward to assert Métis claims to an area once known as Roostertown. Both groups, along with local residents, dog lovers, and naturalists, have fought heroically and courageously to save the Parker Wetlands for important ecological, indigenous, and recreational reasons. In its natural state, the Parker wetlands were composed of broad swaths of grasslands and framed by lush woodlands. There were flora and fauna special to our prairie landscape with well-traveled trails for walking and hiking. In short, it was a beautiful oasis of green space and a much-prized sanctuary away from the travails of modern life. Sadly, Madam Speaker, about a third of the Parker wetlands were bulldozed this summer, leaving a cold, ugly, cross-cut landscape in its wake. What's more, the situation appears to be going from bad to worse. Recently, the Roostertown activists were removed by court order from the land, the bulldozers have returned, and the fate of what remains of the Parker wetlands hangs in the balance. And yet many questions still remain. How did an area once designated as ecologically sensitive by the City of Winnipeg become fit for development? How did this designation disappear? And how was it that this once sensitive green space was swapped for a brownfield? And what happened to the RCMP investigation of this land swap? There are many questions, but few answers. What's worse, Madam Speaker, is the Palliser government is complicit in this sad state of affairs. In March of 2016, the provincial government appointed a consultant to review the situation and make recommendations toward a better, more productive outcome. This report has never seen the light of day. I call on the Minister of Sustainable Development to release the report today. It's likely too little too late, but at least we'll know what might have been had the government been open and transparent from the start. Who knows, it might even offer some guidance towards saving what's left of the Parker wetlands.
Now that was Manitoba NDP MLA James Allum. Has there been any action from provincial or federal government around the issues brought up by the Rooster Town blockade?
Not really. It was really encouraging to hear MLA make that statement. I think it sort of really actualized a lot of what, we thought that we were doing, and just to hear that in the legislature was something quite powerful. I know that there is, plans to reach out to MLA and perhaps other members of the Manitoba NDP caucus to see if, we can sort of collectively build a bit more pressure to maybe drop the lawsuit or something like that. And so we'll see what happens sort of in the future weeks and months. Outside of that, not really anything. There was a report which was actually commissioned by the previous government, the Manitoba NDP, when they were in power, to take a look at what happened with this land swap. And the new government, the Manitoba PCs, received that report, and they kind of sat on it for a number of months and then released it. But it was released in kind of a funny way, in which Bartley Kivez, who's a reporter at CBC, was tweeting about it. But it was really difficult for anyone to actually get their hands on a copy of the report to find out what it said. And from what I understand, it basically sort of cleared all parties of wrongdoing. But I would need to actually look deeper into the report to take a look. All that to say is that, as far as I know, that's all sort of the Manitoba PCs, which are the new government, have done, is, receive a report and then kind of sit on it for a few months and then quietly release it. I don't think that they're overly concerned about this. And I'm guessing that if they had to sort of pick a side, they would probably go with the developer, just given their sort of positions on other issues. As for the federal government, from what I understand, there hasn't been anything. There hasn't been any statements from any of the parties. There hasn't been any support shown. I do think that there is a lot of potential for that, even though it's out of their jurisdiction in terms of, legislation and bylaws and all the rest, just even showing solidarity for what's going on here. Because I do think, in addition to the forest itself and what it represented to people and the history of it, what is happening now with the lawsuit does represent a pretty scary precedent for activists not only in Winnipeg but across the country, in terms of the chilling effect it could have on people's willingness to participate in peaceful protests and such. So one would think that there would be the potential for federal MPs, in addition to provincial MLAs, to sort of take a stand, and just even if they're just saying something in the House of Commons, or if they're issuing a statement or even tweeting about it, all of that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, we'll see.
Now you've mentioned this lawsuit a few times. That's mm-hmm. the next question up. This developer is suing mm-hmm. 49 people over their participation in the blockade. Now mm-hmm. A few questions about that. Are you on that list?
I am, yeah. And I should clarify that the number 49 is like alleged participants. Right. At this point, we're still in the process of being sued, and there are a number of people in that cohort who definitely, they are for sure, say that they never stepped foot on the property and that they have been erroneously named. And so the 49 really does encompass a scattershot of people. But yes, to answer your question, I'm on it.
Now, what is the basis of the lawsuit?
The basis, it's effectively the same as how the urgent injunction was requested and granted in the first place. Was Marquez's claiming that the blockade resulted in what he's called an impaired ability to develop the property, resulting in lost revenues and business opportunities. And so the actual charges include things like trespassing, but the consequences of that, the things that he's actually seeking damages for, are recovering costs for having to install things like fencing and floodlights and security. But bigger than that, and this is sort of a question as to how much and what specifically they're going to be pursuing in the lawsuit. But from what my reading and from the conversations I've had with our lawyers, it's likely that he is going to attempt to once again claim that blockade served to lose him profit that he would have otherwise made, or compromise relationships with contractors, or perhaps jeopardized for example, a multi-million dollar business deal that would have happened, but because of the blockade, it fell through. Now, of course, in an actual trial, they would have to show proof of all of this. You can't just claim it and then not show evidence. So, and that will likely come out and that's up to the judge to determine sort of how much of this is legitimate and how much of this is being perhaps exaggerated. But yeah, at this point, it's really about attempting to recover alleged costs that relate to like the direct costs from having to hire security, all that. But then also, future costs in which he couldn't recover profit because of the blockade.
Right. Being sued for or being targeted for litigation of such an amount, how is this mm-hmm. impacting people? How are they fighting back against this?
So initially, Andrew Marquez's lawyer, Kevin Toyne, sort of mentioned the figure of $500,000, at least $500,000 in damages. And obviously that was pretty scary for many of us, being very low-wage, precarious workers who don't have like $100 saved, let alone anything close to that.
Right.
And then later, once the lawsuit was kind of building in, one would say, reputation, he went to CBC and said damages may actually be in the millions or tens of millions of dollars. And so, who knows what's sort of going on there? I'm not going to speculate on their behalf, but, needless to say, it has a psychological toll, which I think some would argue that is intended. As for response, about half of us retained a law firm. So there's two lawyers working on this case. And so the upfront retainer was around $10,000, and it had to be sort of put together quite quickly. And so that resulted in a need for very immediate call out for fundraising. So there's a GoFundMe campaign, which was sort of pre-existing to that drive, but we did end up raising over $10,000. I think we're at about $12,000 now. So mm-hmm. the retainer is paid down, which means that anyone who is named in the lawsuit and wants to join can do so free of charge. We really want to make it as accessible as possible for people to retain legal counsel, because these sorts of fees can really add up, especially if you're trying to go in on your own or if you're trying to self-represent, which some people have chosen to do. And so that's been the focus. The initial focus was really on trying to raise that $10,000 so that everyone could have access to legal counsel. I would say more long term, there are talks about collaborating with various organizations, other activists in Winnipeg and elsewhere, in terms of just really trying to build pressure with the hope that Marquez changes his mind. And I know that he's a very determined guy, and he knows what he wants, and he often gets what he wants. But the hope is that there's sort of, enough pressure building that might convince him to reconsider this. So that may take on a number of different forms. For example, could be petitions, it could be calls to city council, it could be a number of different things, trying to build awareness and sort of make a convincing case that enough people care about this that it would be in his interest to suspend the lawsuit. So we kind of got the short term of the retainer and the legal fees, and then the long term of maybe something bigger, because the same issues that people were protesting at the blockade, namely colonialism, capitalism. Every person had different reasons for being there, so I don't want to speak as if everyone there is explicitly there for that. But, at root, these are many of the forces that sort of are driving us. They clearly have not gone away, even though many politicians talk very extravagantly about their commitment to reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. Things like this are happening. We just saw Site C given the okay again by, the BC NDP, Muskrat Falls in Labrador. Like, these land offenses are happening constantly. And so I think that would be sort of the very long-term vision for a lot of people in the group. It's just really using this as a way to continue to build awareness that right. this quote-unquote reconciliation that settler states pretend to care about is not necessarily that in practice. And also, some have described what this lawsuit is as a slap, right. like a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And I think there could or there should be additional legislation which really attempts to limit this, because
for sure
it's the belief of a lot of people that peaceful protest is a pretty integral part of what people would like to conceive as democracy. And just because one guy received a large parcel of public lands in one land swap, that doesn't give him the automatic right to clear cut a forest, which means a great deal to a lot of people, uncontested.
Right.
So I think, potentially we could be at some point talking about, deploying a language of, anti-SLAPP, anti-strategic lawsuit against public participation. Yeah, because it's really awful for this to happen to us, but we also know that this is happening to a lot of other groups, and it's been deployed effectively against other groups too. So we'd like to try to take a stand. Although, once again, I should emphasize that I'm only speaking for some of the group. I know
sure.
the members probably basically just want this lawsuit to go away and not to necessarily deal with these issues, which is totally their prerogative. But I would say for many of us, these are what interest us.
Well, I think in Ontario, where anti-SLAPP legislation has been enacted,
mm-hmm.
part of that was the government couldn't resist the fact that SLAPP lawsuits do limit public participation and really mm-hmm. they are kind of an affront to the so-called democratic process.
Definitely.
And so it would be great to see that kind of protection put into Manitoba as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in his legal actions, and this is one of the things that really caught me, was the developer claimed he had to hire private security to keep an mm-hmm. eye on those taking part of the
yeah.
blockade. Can you
yeah.
Share what this surveillance looked like?
It was quite unexpected for a lot of people. So initially it was simply a surveillance van. There was a person sitting in it 24/7. They had a video camera. Every time somebody would walk by, they would be sure to make sure that you felt like you were being surveilled. And I'm sure somewhere on some hard drive somewhere, there are thousands of hours of footage, presumably that they can attempt to build some sort of case based on identifying people. So that was the initial. And then there was an instance where there was a suspected private investigator brought in, and there were a number of people who say that they were actually followed outside of the property itself. Mm-hmm. And this person said some pretty weird stuff to them. And I wasn't there. This didn't happen to me. So I'm not going to try to quote them or anything, but needless to say, it scared the people who it happened to. And those people didn't come back to the site because, being followed outside of that has a very intimidating presence. And, people would begin to wonder, how far is this going to stretch? Am I going to be watched when I'm at home? Can I enjoy myself when I'm out? Is that van driving by something nefarious? Is it not? So that happened, from what I understand, a few days. And then they actually hired an official private security firm, with a labeled SUV and, uniforms and all that kind of thing. And stations one security guard at the gate. So, when you showed up, they would, give you the standard, sort of routine at this private property, trespassing is illegal, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was just sort of an added thing on top of the fact that there was already someone videotaping constantly. And, that person in the van would occasionally move the van, and they would usually stay fairly stationary. But from what I've heard, there were some instances where someone would just be sitting in a tent, and then there'd be this guy videotaping them from, 10 feet away, which, it keeps one on edge,
right.
Which I suspect was part of the point.
Sure.
I'm not Andrew Marquez. I don't know what goes on in his head, but if I was to imagine, I think part of it could possibly have been to intimidate people from showing up.
I could believe that if that was the case, whether it is
sure.
or not.
I'm just trying to speak very cautious.
Right. Well, obviously Marquez has the resources to mount a legal campaign, and I know mm-hmm. the impact of those that can have on people,
mm-hmm.
on your individual life, but also just your ability to participate in your community and in
Absolutely.
further action. So be as cautious as you need to be with the language.
No, for sure. I appreciate that.
What's going on now at the park, the Parker mm-hmm. Wetlands, this area, and are people still working to resist the land developments there? Are there actual, has land development continued?
Nobody has been back onto the site since the injunction was granted, because if any of us do return, it's we immediately get arrested.
Right.
I know some people have been have showed up just to sort of watch what's been going on from off the property and been really careful to make sure that they're not stepping on it and such. And so from reports that I've heard from people who have showed up, the clear cutting has continued. From what I understand, almost all the forest is gone. I think they're preparing to develop. Last I heard, and this could have changed, but from what I understand, Marquez still hasn't submitted or hasn't had a development plan approved by the city to actually proceed with the development. And so this was a tricky thing that we had to figure out at the time was is clear cutting considered to be a part of development, which would have to actually receive a development permit? permit to proceed with. And from what I understand, that's not the case. So that they could clear cut, they could prepare the site for development without actually receiving a development plan.
Right.
So I think they've done everything that they effectively can. Interestingly, Marquez actually got dinged like $170,000 a couple years ago for building, I think it was one or two apartment buildings without a permit. And so I would suspect that he's a little more cautious about these kind of things, and he's probably very aware of what he's allowed to do and what he's not allowed to do. And so from what I understand, yeah, most of the forest has been clear cut. There's also adjacent properties which are owned by, like, there's the city of Winnipeg actually bought a parcel of the land, like a small parcel, to build like a retention pond a couple years ago. So I mean, that's technically on the same land. And then there's also like a railroad track in Manitoba Hydro as a transmission line, like, close by too. So there's always lots of activity there when you show up. Whether that is to do with Marquez specifically or not, I'm not sure. And yeah, like I said, I haven't been back in a long while just because it definitely has like a certain, you know, feel to it. Like every time that you walk by, it's like, wow, like this was a time for 2 months. And now to think of sort of going back with the potential of being immediately arrested. And at the time, they were very willing to call the cops for what I would suggest was not necessary. Like, for example, we showed up with a large container of water one day, you know, like in one of those big sort of like blue jerry cans.
Right.
And cops showed up within minutes because they had a call from a community member that we were bringing in gasoline to light the place on fire. Now, why we would do that to our own tents and our own equipment is beyond me. But, you know, like, so those sort of things have, I would say, deterred a lot of people from returning. So at this point, I think it's been clear cut, and they're just prepping for next stages of development.
Right. Now, I know things are still going on in terms of the lawsuit. Has there been any time to reflect on the blockade? Like, has there been lessons that you want to share?
Yeah. Just to sort of wrap up on the lawsuit. So basically, like, all of us are waiting to be served. So, like, we're just waiting to be sued. And so, you know, that could happen tomorrow. It could happen a couple of weeks from now. But it will happen at some point. As for lessons learned, like, we meetings as a group just to sort of like plot out strategy and next steps and such. And so I think a lot of it has been quite immediate. Like, you know, how do we, or like, do we want to host an event to raise more money to pay for legal fees or whatever? But I think generally speaking, like, in terms of lessons learned, like, for me as a settler, as a cis male, it was just like an experience of, you know, like, learning how to follow Indigenous leadership and just to really, you know, show up when called upon. And definitely not saying I was perfect or that any of the settlers who participated were perfect, but I think it was like an experience, and just like really being reminded of that was really important. I think just very practical technical skills around, you know, communication and, you know, making sure everyone has access to the same communication channels, and so people aren't feeling left out, or if a call goes out for support, that people aren't being, you know, miss things like, you know, how to build a schedule. I didn't do any of the scheduling myself. I'm very grateful for the people that did, and just like, you know, just really keeping on top of things like that. I would say from like a, I don't know, emotional point of view, just like really being cognizant of burnout and how that works, and how, you know, for maybe a week or two, you can sort of withstand a lot of pressures, you know, from being surveilled, or, you know, just the feelings of being on, you know, private property, and, you know, just really figuring out proper, you know, routines and not to lapse into really bad habits to get through these, you know, particular phases. Because I think, you know, people can be really, really strong for, you know, quite a long time, and then everything hits at once, and then you're out of commission for like months, which happened to me. So it's like, I would say that was a lesson learned, is just like for myself, just how to pace myself and how to commit my energies without, you know, getting overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And just like stuff like networking with other organizations. And I think it was definitely a crash course in just, how do you get the word out to people about stuff like this? I mean, there are dozens of issues in every single city. You know, like, how do you sort of help people to care, or, you know, distinguish this from many other issues in which people are committing time and energy to. And yeah, I definitely don't have answers to that. If anyone does, hit me up. I'd love to hear.
Definitely. And we'll get your contact information at the end of
for
the year.
Sure.
How can people support those targeted in the lawsuit? You mentioned this, this GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. I see GoFundMe.com/481WBF4. Or search legal help for Roostertown blockade. And yeah, it's over $12,000 of a $15,000 goal. So I hope, like, obviously that's part of it. Is there other things they can do?
I would say just, like, sort of spread the word when appropriate. Just be like, hey, have you heard about this situation in Winnipeg? Press Progress, which is a sort of publication of Broadband Institute, is a really fabulous piece, sort of when rumors of the lawsuit were first coming out. And so even just like looking to pieces like that, just to sort of get a primer on what's going on. If you just Google Press Progress, Roostertown, I'm sure it'll come up. And yeah, just especially, you know, settlers, just like educating oneself about, you know, what's going on in Canada. Like we had a Art Manuel quote that was sort of draped on the side of the tent, and we had, you know, some like his book on Settling Canada just like sitting around. Like, that's a great resource. Buy or rent or borrow or whatever Unsettling Canada by Art Manuel. I believe he has a new book too called Reconciliation Manifesto. Just like there's a plethora of books out there about Indigenous struggles and, you know, sovereignty and all the rest. So I'd say for settlers, it's just like really important to keep on top of that and to remember that, you know, there can be no justice in Canada without, you know, really centering the struggles of Indigenous peoples. And yeah, I don't know, just even just tweeting at us and just saying, hey, we support you, or like, because like it can get kind of lonely, you know,
right?
Like you're doing this, you're keeping your head down, and there is fatigue from supporters, you know, like, you know, family, friends. Like, I know that we appreciate all the support that we've got, but we're potentially facing like a 5 or 7 year process. If a trial happens, it might not happen until, you know, 2022, 2023, you know, that's many tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees until then. So like, you know, just keeping us in mind, you know, hopefully we won't be too overbearing with our social media presence or anything, because I know there are a lot of causes to care about, but even just reaching out and saying, hey, we support you, chipping in some money to our legal fund. Yeah, anything like that is just like hugely appreciated.
Sure.
Because, yeah, it's a struggle for sure.
Right. Anything you'd like to add that we didn't cover? Anything that was...
Reiterate again, just so, you know, fellow defendants don't get upset at me, is that, you know, stuff I've talked about is effectively my own position, and I would say the position of like a good chunk of the group, but there are some people who aren't particularly invested in these sort of like longer term struggles, and just want the lawsuit to be done with and just life to go back to normal, which I get 100%. So yeah, I guess just that. And yeah, you can follow us on Twitter. The Twitter account is RoostertownMB. So hit us up there. We haven't been super active lately, but we're gonna try to get more into that soon. And yeah, tell your friends.
Well, thanks a lot for the interview today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. It means a lot to have support from Waterloo and from elsewhere.
Well, this has been our interview with James Wilt.
For more information on the Roostertown blockade at the Parker Wetlands, check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/roostertownblockade. On Twitter, RoostertownMB. You can email them, roostertownlegalfund@gmail.com, or check out the GoFundMe, GoFundMe.com/481WBF4, or legal help for Roostertown blockade. This is Dan Keller for AWOL Radio.
And we're going to go to a song right now. This is Byron, Here's to the Land, on AWOL Radio.
Old folks are coming from all over town, coming here now just to put you down, coming with their families and they're coming with their friends, coming here now to put it all to an end. Here's to the land that you've torn out the heart of, that your money and your guns that you can't get by. In the night when the the house creaks and the floorboards moan. Hope you shiver in your bed thinking of all the shit you've done. In the midnight hour when you finally close your eyes, in your dreams there'll be terrors and you'll know why. Here's to the land that you've torn out the heart of. Bet your money and your guns that you can't get far enough. For all the meadows you've torn up and the trees you've ripped down, for all the mines that you've scratched into the face of the land, well, they'll get you in a corner and there you pay your dues. You'll be paying with your blood, you'll be screaming black and blue. Here's to the land that you've torn out the heart of. Bet your money and your guns that you can't get far enough. Here's to the land that you've torn out the heart. Bet your money and your guns that you can't get far enough.